Okay, my name is Gary. I'm an alcoholic. And a pleasure to see you. I mean, when it gets to be 9:30 on a Saturday night, and what have you guys been doing? You've been listening to people talk all day. Oh boy, you get to do it some more, you know. But I really appreciate you folks making it over here for this. And as a topic, many of you know the famous name Clancy, and he does a Seconds and Inches kind of talk about the history of Alcoholics Anonymous. And what this is, by and large, is something that is along those lines. And this is actually this piece is actually titled King Charles of New York City. Now, probably you weren't aware that there was a King Charles of New York City, but that's supposed to be the hook. On page 7 of the big book, you'll see some words which you might have been skipping over in the past. And it's those words are, my brother-in-law, who happened to be Leonard Strong, is a physician, and through his kindness and that of my mother, I was placed in a nationally known hospital. That's Towns Hospital. And for the mental and physical rehabilitation of alcoholics, under the so-called Belladonna treatment, my brain cleared. Best of all, I met a kind doctor, Dr. Silkworth, who explained, though certainly selfish and foolish, I had been seriously ill, bodily and mentally. Now, this is actually a talk about Charles Towns, proprietor of Towns Hospital. On page 19 of the big book, it says, of necessity, there will have to be discussion of matters medical, psychiatric, social, and religious. We are aware that these matters are, from their very nature, controversial. Nothing would please us so much as to write a book which would contain no basis for contention or argument. We shall do the utmost to achieve that ideal. Charles Towns is the flip negative of that. He is as controversial as can be. And for that reason, and yet to be explored, that is why I'm a believer anyway, he's intentionally been ignored. Bill Wilson, along with his singleness of purpose, knew how much controversy that was surrounding this as an individual. And so, by and large, he stayed away from it. But in the time period we are generally looking at, more than 100 years ago, actually as much as 110 years ago, Charles Towns was born in LaGrange, Georgia. Okay, so he's a local product, born in 18, of all, would you believe, all the way back in 1862. Now, here are some things that people wrote about him over the years. Of all the cure proclaimers, there was an undisputed king, or perhaps emperor. So magnificent were his accomplishments and so influential his lobbying, Mr. Charles B. Towns. He worked at such a high level of national and international efforts to control narcotics that he appeared to be many to be above mercenary considerations. Now, you're going to hear narcotics in this because we are dealing with history here. Okay, and I can't doctor it to be any different than what it was, all right? But incidentally, also, as long as we get to narcotics, 100 years ago, narcotics meant any kind of substance which led to a state of drowsiness. And actually, that if you go back and look at the actual meaning of the word, that is a derivation of the words, that's where narcotics actually comes from. Another quote about Towns, and it would not surprise me, for one, if the world sooner or later should discover that it must listen to Towns. I believe the fact is now established that with reasonable intelligence and care, his treatments can be applied anywhere, particularly with the advice and aid of Towns himself. Here's William White talking about Towns. The story of Charles B. Towns Hospital is a story of a most fascinating institution by a most fascinating man. He was so personally persuasive and dominating that some observers even questioned whether the results of a treatment for addiction might be more attributed to the power of their personality than to the medical protocol used at his hospital. As one physician noticed the Towns treatment would be all right if you could mix in a grain of Towns with every capsule. And in 1912, he will be, as he is, simply the experienced, enthusiastic leader of perhaps what is perhaps the first intelligent crusade against these most insinuating and baffling enemies to the human character, alcohol and drugs. Excepting perhaps those few open-minded physicians who had worked close to him, it transpired that no one in the world knew quite so much about these matters as Towns. Above all this, he had happened through one of the chances that nature seems to arrange to be the right man in the right place. The problem had stirred the genius within him and found an answer there. Pretty flowery stuff, isn't it? Here's an odd story of an old man with an odd adventures whose virile personality backed a nationwide campaign in which not one individual in America was without personal interest. Here's one more. Anyone who knows Towns knows one of the most persuasive and dominating personalities in the world. Pretty impressive stuff. Now, and you might see be sitting there going, how come I've never heard of this guy? Well, all of you have. Anybody that has been in step two of the 12 and 12, this is Charlie. Does that ring a bell? This is Charlie, the Charlie that gave the job offer to Bill Wilson. Now, incidentally, the only place you'll ever hear him referred to as Charlie is within AA. Because Bill, that's what Bill called him. But everywhere else, in the decades that preceded that, it's Charles Towns. Charles Barnes Towns, it's always formal. Now, why did he call him Charlie? I don't know. Okay, but I think it was part of how Bill wanted us to focus on what was really important. Working steps, getting sober. And I'm convinced it's our book is so non-controversial by intent that sometimes when you look at what the story really was behind it, he's got his focus, but there's a lot more to the story. And what I really want to help you do as part of this exercise is when you do read your big book next time, I would buy page 7 and never notice that word belladonna at all. Okay, and then with the bit about wanting to be non-controversial, he says so, and how well he actually achieved. Especially, I mean, when you think when the big book was written and how dark times that those were, storm clouds, war, and everything else. And I just get more and more impressed. And particularly in the nature of how the times that the big book was created.
What about the original manuscript? Do you draw any conclusions from that?
Not really. Not with regards to we have a copy of that.
The redlining and the circlers and all the notes.
Yeah, but the people, Hank Parkhurst did a lot of those circling. There's a Dr. Howard that did much more of the contributions. To changing, he's the one that came up with we versus I everywhere throughout the book, and so actually, with regards to Towns had an impact on the big book, believe it or not, but the impact was financial. I'll get to that as this goes on. But the late Bill Pittman, in a book called AA: The Way It Began. Starts off Charles Towns' biography this way. Charles Towns was born in 1862 in a small farm near LaGrange, Georgia. During his youth, he broke horses and mules and steers that no other person could conquer. But the farm became too easy for Charlie, and he took to railroading. He used his spare time to study arithmetic and grammar. Railroading yielded somewhat to his aggressive disposition, but he soon tired of it and turned his attention to life insurance. Towns, with his threatening index finger and his hypnotic eye and prehensile jaw, could convince a granite gatepost that it stood in immediate need of life insurance. Okay, he set a record for selling more life insurance than any other man had ever written south of the Mason-Dixon line up to that time in 1901. A very dominating, very persuasive personality, really, to start with, who went up to New York to be in the brokerage business. That lasted 3 years. And that business went under. But meanwhile, a mysterious man provided him the belladonna treatment. Now, we don't know who that was. It's never been documented. And the first treatments that Towns did were just literally bizarre. In other words, they got a volunteer to treat, and then the guy didn't like it, and he wanted to leave, and Towns said, I'm going to treat you or give you a harp. you know, the guys ended up surviving this. But very quickly, Towns, with his ability to connect to people, connected to Alexander Lambert, a doctor. And Alexander Lambert happened to be Teddy Roosevelt's personal physician. Okay, so Towns starts to be very well connected. And through a variety of circumstances, he ends up being an ambassador that perfects the belladonna treatment, which was known as the Towns treatment. He perfected it in the land of where there was rumored to be 160 million opium addicts. He perfected it in China. And he treated 4,000 people there, apparently successfully. So it was believed at the time. But there's a lot of drama here, because there's scenes that are literally, he's written up as Indiana Jones sitting in China with a revolver on his lap, another one in his holster, and he is he has these signs up that it's Town Hospital written in Chinese, and the Empress of China is telling them to take the sign down because she's chosen somebody else as her favorite. And he just says, basically, baloney. That's the way the story is written up, that here he is in the middle of this one American in the midst of all of this opium chaos, and here he is. It's tough to make up, but actually the opium wars of opium in China had been there not many that many years before, and the Chinese did not have a military force, and they were scared to death of inviting the Marines back into China. And so they let Towns get away with this bizarre behavior. But it made for great press for Towns, who comes back to the United States literally as a hero, with having the only known opium cure in the world. Okay. And that is how he got a great claim to fame now. The belladonna treatment, which I'll get to, which was known as the Towns treatment or the Towns-Lambert treatment, gets written in the Journal of the American Medical Association in 1909. He is connected, and the belladonna treatment is thought of as be state-of-the-art. It is a belief at the times that medical treatment that there would be a medical treatment that could successfully treat anything. That was, by and large, the thought of the a time period. Now, incidentally, also as of 1909, there were no federal laws on narcotics whatsoever. Georgia had implemented a law against cocaine in 1902, and there were certain state laws relative to particular substances, but there were no federal laws regarding it all. As a matter of fact, at the times, and it's hard to kind of believe, but you could go to, the typical Walgreens at the time, get your patent medicine. It could contain heroin, opium, or cocaine, or morphine, and you might like the medicine a whole lot. You don't have the foggiest idea what's in it, because until 1906, in the Pure Food and Drug Act, there was no necessity to declare what the ingredients were in anything. So, that was to change, but it was Towns who got on his started to say how that was wrong, and he started accusing both the druggists and the physicians for being the cause of drug addiction in the United States. Okay, because a lot of people really didn't know that they were playing with a kind of fire. Now the And so he comes back as a conquering hero. He opens his first, they're somewhat disputed. He's such a salesman that I think he exaggerates, but I think he opened his first hospital in 1909. He gets a lot of, he has the support of the medical community. There was a Dr. Richard Cabot of Massachusetts General Hospital up in Boston that comes to his defense and writes him up. And then in 1912, he has much of a flair of dramatic in his choice of written language. I mean, apparently, even though he had only an eighth grade education, he ends up using the English language in a rather dramatic way. And his first article in 1912 and I apologize for any of you tobacco smokers, involves cigarettes and tobacco. And to that he says, I consider that cigarette smoking is the greatest vice devastating humanity today, because it is doing more than any other vice to deteriorate the race. Now also, this is something you remember, for particularly in reference to Bill Wilson, he says, it is very significant that in dealing with alcoholism, no real reform can be expected if the patient does not give up tobacco. Again, most men who have ever used alcohol to excess, if restricted voluntarily or involuntarily, will use tobacco to excess. This excess in tobacco produces a narcotic effect, which temporarily blunts the craving for alcohol. And another way of saying the same thing is that when smokers are drunk, they no longer care to smoke. That is exactly the opposite of what I, when I drank, I don't know where he came up with that, but nevertheless, that was, but cigarettes was the only thing, actually, the only bad habit, the addictive habit that he ever had. And incidentally, he never quotes anybody as an authority, because guess what? He's the authority. Okay? So, but again, when you look at page 135 of the Big Book, it has a story in there that is written in the family afterwards about, and without, the gist of it is there was a friend that was a heavy smoker and a coffee drinker, and the wife complains, right? And he all goes out and gets drunk. And of course, he's dead wrong, but of course, Bill Wilson writes that the wife was dead wrong for criticizing him, right? For, and it ends with, she sees she was wrong to make a burning issue out of such a matter when his more serious ailments were rapidly being cured. Cured. We got cured in the Big Book. Now, supposedly, anybody knows, but I think Bill lost it a little bit when he went in there. And, of course, he smoked the rest of his life and so on, but so he used the... Now, so that was also another reason why he probably, you know, Towns was not at the top of this list. There's Help for the Hard Drinker, which came out in June of 1912. Again, very colorful language. With increasing unanimity, the thinkers of the world are saying that alcohol is found to be the greatest of humanity's curses. It does no good whatsoever. It does incalculable harm. And alcohol has worked greater havoc in the aggregate than all the plagues. If not another drop of it should ever be distilled, the world would be a gainer, not the loser, through circumstance. Yet the use of alcohol is continually increasing. The number of its victims sums a growing total. Sentimentalists have failed to cope with it, and the law has failed to cope with it. In combating it, the world must now find some method more effective than any it has yet employed. He's looking at the world banning alcohol. He doesn't set his sights too low. Okay, the peril of the drug habit was August of 1912, and that's where he does deal with, you know, with the evil of drugs. Now, incidentally, also in his time, remember that there were four: morphine, opium, heroin, cocaine, and then again until 1906, the Pure Food and Drug Act. That's when people finally had to declare that was something in them. Just so that instant, it might be of interest to you that amphetamines were not invented until the mid-late 30s, and they were used originally as a nasal decongestant, but then both sides used them as a stimulant during World War II for their obvious advantages to stay awake. And then in October of 1912, I find this very interesting because sometimes he can be so wrong, but then sometimes he can be on the button. What is commonly spoken of as the American type, highly nervous, living under pressure, always going to the full limit or beyond, is peculiarly liable to disorders that lead to the habitual use of drugs. We are all hypochondriacal by, I can say the word, by... prone to take something wherever we feel badly. Lack of opportunity to loan, knowledge of what to take and how to procure it has saved many a person under severe physical or mental strain from recklessly resorting to drugs. That line, I, in all honesty, I think is more true today than when he wrote it. By 1914, he opens his hospital on 293 Central Park West. Now, you know, if any of you are familiar with New York, that's about as prestigious of an address as you can get. It's on Millionaire's Row. I mean, on Central Park, it's directly across the street from the Jackie Kennedy Onassis Reservoir. This is top shelf stuff. But of course, Towns has his own opinions about how treatment would be performed. He wants payment up front. He wants it to be $350. Multiply that by 12, give you an idea. That might be $8,000 up front. It's for wealthy, but he wants it to be your own money. He wants it to be your own money because then he figures it'll mean something to you. Okay, and so that's kind of a self-supporting through your own contributions kind of a thing, in a way. But he has people that he feels that have very little chance for recovery. Those are the vagrant poor, who's using somebody else's money, or the vagrant rich, who don't care about money at all. Feels that because of the medical treatment, he is able to detoxify you in a very brief period of time. He's going to make the treatment really will be 5 to 7 days, maybe 10 days on the outset. And the faster he makes more money, the quicker he gets you out the door. So it's a completely different model for alcoholism treatment whatsoever. And he begins writing various articles advocating the special kinds of hospitals, based like the hospitals at Towns, should be open throughout the country. He claimed a cure rate of 75 to 90%. Sometimes it's even more than that. But that also turned out to be a huge boomerang. All right. In 1915, he comes out with his book, the one book you can probably get today, and that's Habits That Handicap. Much of that book is based on some of the magazine articles I already mentioned, but when it comes to drugs, he says, no human longing can compare in intensity with that of the drug user for his drug. Unrelieved, he will let nothing stand between him and it. Neither hunger, nakedness, starvation, arson, theft, nor murder will keep him from his substance that he craves. Clearly, humanity must be protected against this evil. This begins a climate of fear, of which he was just one. Now, again, we go from 1909, when drugs are completely legal, according to federal law, and we go until 1919, when drug prohibition is firmly implemented. That's just in 10 years. But by and large, there's also elements of fear of the Germans during World War I coming in and using drugs. There was morphine in drugs that were used as in Germany. You thought that would be used against us, but there also the amount of rhetoric that took place in scaring people about drugs as an evil led their entire banishment. Of interest also, he claimed 75 to 90%, but using himself as an authority. How could he base that as a number? Okay, well, this is how he reasoned it. If you never heard from a patient again, he no longer needed your services. Towns that he should have now, you know. So he didn't want to hear from you. Okay, that was as scientific as that was. Now, incidentally, also when you were in Towns Hospital. The patient should have individual treatment for each case and must be kept away from other patients. When they get together, they talk of their symptoms, conditions, habits, and effects on them. He thinks it impossible to cure patients as long as they are in conversation with each other. They also must be, it was essential to get the poisons out of your system. And what the town's treatment was purgative. You would purge it from your system. I'll go to the treatment just for a minute. The treatment had a tropa belladonna. It was otherwise known as deadly nightshade. Its side effects were delirium, hallucinations, light sensitivity, confusion, and dry mouth. Contained atropine. It being potentially deadly, it derived its name from atropos, one of the three fates who, according to Greek mythology, shows how a person was to die. And then there's other ingredients, Hyoscyamus niger, also known as henbane, hogsbane, or insane root. Then there's xanthalum, the dried bark of berries of Xanthalum americanum, or prickly ash, which is a tree, added to help with diarrhea and intestinal cramps. There were other things used to help stimulate bowel elimination, and a chloral hydrate might be used to put the patient to sleep. It was actually a step-down treatment because what the theory was at the time, if you were addicted to whatever substance it was, they would give you half of the dosage that you were getting along with the belladonna, and they'd step you down. This would be a treatment which would go on for 50 hours in a row. There's no way in the world that this treatment could be portrayed in My Name Is Bill W., for obvious reasons, unless you wanted to make it literally X-rated. But they were actually looking for the particular, a kind of a greenish stool. I'm sorry if that sounds gross, but it's also the truth. That also made it such that a critic of the town's treatment called it diarrhea, delirium, and damnation. There really was no way to portray it. And of course, Bill Wilson relapsed 3 times, and it was actually his 4th treatment when he said, "Then the usual treatment began: barbiturates to temper me down, doses of belladonna, and a little sedative. I wasn't in bad shape this time. It would have taken now how bad he was during that 4th." event is somewhat disputed. He actually, depending upon when he wrote it, gives a different picture in terms of how whether or not he was as close to DTs or not. Again, getting back to Towns Hospital, individual rooms, absolute privacy, private telephones, personal nurse or valet, florist, billiards. Were available. You had a solarium up on the upper floor. Later on, he also had physical therapists. And he vacillated depending upon what year it was in terms of whether or not alcoholism was a disease. He starts off saying it was, then he says it's ridiculous, then later on he says it's a disease again. Sometimes I don't think he remembered what he wrote. Okay. But when if you have a cure rate of 90%, they're supposed to be so high. There was, during the 1910s, the thinking was, is that, well, gee, if the cure rate was so high, why would anyone ever stay on maintenance through morphine? Just take the cure and get it done. And because of the high claim rate for drug addiction, which he made and many others did, that led to the belief anyway that doctors were only trying to exploit their patients, and eventually the doctors themselves became under criminal investigation. The doctors washed their hands of it altogether, and with the general climate of fear that decade ended with, we ended up with drug prohibition altogether. No constitutional amendment was required for it, and then also people were outside were started to recognize that the belladonna treatment, the cure rate was, or it wasn't a cure rate, more or less. The relapse rate was extremely high because obviously a lot of things were involved more than even if you did purge the poisons, if you bought that. You know, we talk about today how you send old people back to old playgrounds and playmates and how futile that is. I mean, there's so much else involved in getting sober, and here he just said that this magic potion was going to somehow physically remove all of the craving and you won't want to use it again. Well, yeah, but then you go back to your buddies and, you know, there's the bar and what else do you have to do? You get drunk again, right? So, even though the belladonna treatment was discredited, and of course prohibition went into effect, that the business of Towns Hospital during the 20s was very good, very lucrative. The beginning of the Depression, he ends up starting to write again because he needs the money. And that's Reclaiming the Drinker. It was written in 1931, where he describes the alcoholic. He laughs boisterously at anything or nothing at all. His emotions are near the surface. He will make ardent love to a woman he met only a half hour before. He may run the emotional gamut. He may be elated or melancholy, scornful or sympathetic. His sexual desires may be easily aroused. He will take chances that never in his sober senses would he dare to take, both with respect to the possibility of venereal infection and the possibility of robbery or blackmail by the woman or her accomplices. An alcoholic as a parent. Indeed, I am convinced that our morons, grown women whom psychological tests prove to have only the medical capacity of our 12 or 13-year-old girls and from whose the ranks prostitutes are largely recruited, are thus cursed because of the alcoholized parentage. This also applies to our gunmen and gangsters, many who show similar traits of mental decadence and moron incapacity. Jeez, and this is a particular favorite. The truth about beer. Okay, contrary to generally accepted belief, beer is proportionally much more noxious than our wines or liquors. While liquor makes a man brutal and dulls his judgment, beer makes him slow-witted and abolishes judgment. And while wine or brandy in sufficient quantity makes a man crazy, beer in corresponding quantity makes him stupid. And between insanity and stupidity, there's merely a question of choice. Some of us prefer an interesting maniac to a brutalized idiot. So he didn't understate much of anything, which then gets us, though, to Bill Wilson. When Bill Wilson shows up at Towns Hospital, of course, that's December of 1934. Towns is 72 years old. Okay, that might have something to do with Charlie. But then our tradition too says our group purpose, there's one ultimate authority, a loving God, is who may express himself in our group conscience. And this is when Charlie gives Bill the job offer. Now there's a book on Silkworth by Dale Mitchell that for the first time, I never saw this before, he documented the job offer to Bill Wilson at $700 a month. Put that into a cost of living adjustment. Bill Wilson was offered $144,000 salary a year, and actually he might have been offered part ownership in the hospital as well, and his group conscience turned it down. Okay, that way, and incidentally, he was also offered four times as much money as Silkworth was offered when Silkworth went to work at Towns Hospital in 1930. Silkworth went there for $40 a week. Or, you know, it would have been $160 a month, but Wilson was offered $700. And that's, Towns was starting to see that what was going on with Bill Wilson and this group of drunks was entirely contrary to the model of what he'd seen before. Because Bill had been, was wandering the halls of Towns Hospital, and Towns was seeing this work right in front of his eyes. It also augments a lot of Silkworth, because, you know, Silkworth the personal attention that he ended up giving to Bill Wilson is entirely contrary to the model that of what Towns had talked about. As a matter of fact, even the when I was talking to you about the disease, where Towns vacillated on that, it may have been how to not cause any problem with his employer, Silkworth decided on the term allergy. All right. And, you know, you do see in tradition too, Charlie finished at his desk and came up with an old financial statement, handing it to me. He continued, shows the kind of money the hospital used to make back in the 20s, thousands of dollars a month. You should be doing just as well now. And he goes on to continue the offer. It's just as a book that Bill Wilson used with Common Sense of Drinking was a book written by Richard Peabody, who did become a lay therapist and wrote a book in 1931. And half measures avail us nothing. That verb avail may have come. Billy might have used it because the same phrase is is in Common Sense of Drinking. And it's just one of those things that, you know, Bill being prone to depression, as he was recognizably, Richard Peabody died drunk in 1936. Had Bill taken the job and tried to professionalize AA, it might have been very bad for him, not to mention what else might have gone on. And it's just also that there's also that Towns was in every way, shape, and form an atheist, and he was very much of a pragmatist. And the idea of weed gathering together as a force is not present anywhere in any of the literature. He wrote 3 books, over 30 magazine articles, quite prolific on that regard. It just sounds trivial, though, also that Dr. Bob used the Towns treatment in Akron in treating a fellow by the name of Eddie. You find that in Dr. Bob and the Good Old Timers. So that Towns treatment had been spread around. But then you get down again to the legacy of Charles Towns, and there are a number of things that were good. He was among the pioneers that encouraged directors of large corporations to help save alcoholics and while still on the job and rehabilitate them and put them back on the job. I mean, I think to the employers, to a degree, it may not be an entirely a coincidence that that would happen to be in the big book. Towns was doing that. I mentioned to you that he did hire Dr. Silkworth, and of course, without Dr. Silkworth, who I don't know where Bill Wilson would have been after his quote-unquote hot flash. That's his word. That's not being sarcastic, but that's what the words that Bill Wilson used. Towns was a supporter and creditor of Alcoholics Anonymous to the tune of $4,000. In other words, and I only came across this relatively recently in a letter from Bill Wilson to Frank Amos dated the 4th of January of 1939. He documents how Towns was loaning him $200 a month for him to live off of, and Ruth Hawk was getting $100 a month. That was up to the tune he was providing money to the AA Foundation up to the tune of $4,000, which was truly half of the money that they borrowed. That's including all the stock options that were provided. So most likely the only reason why we had a big book in April of 1939 was directly because of Charles Towns as well. When it came to, of course, there was no ability to sell the big books. And so in September of 1939, the Liberty article, we have one back over there, that was a direct result of Charles Towns going to a friend of his, Morris Markey, who wrote the article, and going to Fulton Orsler, who was the fellow that was the editor of that magazine. So it was Towns' connection that gave us the first publicity to Liberty in Liberty Magazine. So actually, and Towns did come around. He lived to be 85. He died in 1947. But again, Towns Hospital being the place that, again, he had 4 shots, and of course, it wasn't his money, which violates the bottle as well. It was his mother's or his brother-in-law's. But, you know, we get around then to this magical potion of belladonna, and it's, you know, did he have the white light experience because of belladonna or whatever? And generally the conclusion of that is it's inconsequential. It really doesn't mean anything at all. It was Silkworth that was there at the right time to say, whatever you're doing, this is better than what you had before. And that in a program that speaks, action speaks louder than words, it's what he did for the next 36 years that matter. Whether or not, I know, the things that go a long way, where is you know, he spoke for himself with what he did. And but last but not least, I mean, with all of the talk of substances that and I, with all the research that I've been doing, looking at this, people actually thought that you know, this substance or that substance was going to be the medical cure. What really did happen when Dr. Bob met Bill Wilson and the two of them talked for 6 hours and 15 minutes, that's how long they talked, and came up with an idea of their solution that was drug-free and spiritual in nature. I look at this through all the chaos that went before, and that accomplishment, that spark that was in Akron, becomes just more incredible and as much of a miracle as anything I can imagine or encounter. Thank you. That's good enough.
I was going to ask you, I don't know why this wasn't in that part of the book, but I had a chance to meet Smitty,
mm-hmm.
which was Dr. Bob's son.
Right.
And he told me that at the time, well, actually before Dr. Setworth passed away, that Bill was still working at Towns Hospital.
Well, Bill really never had a job as such at Towns Hospital at all. I mean, he could have visited the hallowed halls, but by that time, you know, they had their own offices as such. So, you know, I actually don't know how much exposure that that he had to Towns, but he might have been, you know, pulling for drunks from time to time at Towns Hospital. And going back and visiting Silkworth. Silkworth lived until 1951.
Now, Silkworth left Towns Hospital, didn't he? Did I read that?
He had multiple hats. He was also had medical responsibilities at other hospitals as well. But he was also, by the time he died, I think he was 78 years old in 51, so he was slowing down. He was slowing down, too.
What happened to Towns Hospital? It closed?
Towns Hospital stayed open until 1965. It was run by his son, Colonel Ed Towns, until the closure. In 1960, Colonel Ed Towns spoke at Long Beach and gave a history of Towns Hospital then at the International in 1960. But generally, the way medical insurance started to work and Blue Cross and so forth, more or less the times were that they just couldn't make a go of it anymore. And also, I mean, the address, I don't know what the economics really of it were, but you don't find treatment centers in extremely wealthy neighborhoods. I mean, they're just not like that, no. Not to mention that, again, it became very bad for business. Alcoholics had a lot more respect than drug addicts, okay? And he could not attract drug addicts and to the neighborhood. That was that was going to be bad for business, okay? So that's where, and you'll see the, I have a board in back at the, where we were, whatever, and you can see in 1917, he has big ads that are run there. Some of them are two pages, and it'll always be drugs and alcohol. And that's in 1917, but by 1921, it starts to get more like hypnotics, which sleeping, you know, and neurasthenia, nerve for nervous people, talks about prohibition, okay, but there's no banner about drugs anymore. He had to adapt to the times, and he really did. But Towns Hospital by 1920 was entirely alcohol, but it's just its roots were entirely in opium. Mm-hmm. But times change, and he But that's the, you know, and I had no idea when I was starting all this that that would be what was revealed.
Yeah. Very good.
Thank you, Bill.
I got the idea when you were talking about Charlie Towns being a stockbroker originally when he went to New York, and Bill was a stockbroker. There must have been some sort of affinity there between the two because of their careers at one time.
Could be.
I'm thinking. Maybe that's why he called him Charlie. Maybe he did it to cover up Charles Towns.
I don't know. I don't know. That's where this stuff is ongoing. A lot of because I gave something like this before, and this is a heck of a lot different than what was here before. Go ahead.
Although this might be a silly question, my name is Malik. I'm an alcoholic. But was Towns a doctor?
No.
So he was never a doctor. He just owned the property that the hospital was.
He had, again, such a forceful personality for you to think of him as a doctor. Some people did, and he is in some literature, if you find it within AA literature on the web, he is called Dr. Towns. Okay? But he had an eighth grade education. But nevertheless, in his peak, 1916 through 1918, he was publishing in magazines The Modern Hospital. A Modern Hospital, the Medical Review of Reviews. Everybody else that published in those magazines were doctors, except for him. Okay, but that was just how convincing this guy was. Now, and imagine, you know, the way I started this is, where did he get his first... He was breaking horses and bulls that no one else... And that's what a dynamic personality this fellow really had, that from anyone that was actually... with him. That's how dynamic, and that's where this Indiana Jones characters or Harold Hill, we got trouble right here in River City, I mean, because of the game of pool, but that was because there were cigarettes there. Okay, that's where how he behaved, and he was very good at it. Yes.
The book that you mentioned is on Kindle, and it has a cost of zero.
What's the name of it?
Habits That Handicap.
There is, if I'm not mistaken, Peabody and Roland Hazard share another common thing together. The guy wrote The Common Sense, and they both got sober under another lay therapist by the name of Courtney Baylor. Mm-hmm. We have no evidence that Carl Jung ever treated Roland Hazard in the 1930s.
No.
But we have letters from Roland Hazard back to his first cousin in 1926. And they're actually waiting for Roland's wife to get off a drunk in Paris. And then when she gets off the drunk in Paris, he's handed over to a lay therapist and goes off and starts playing golf and all this other stuff. And a year later, one cousin's writing the other cousin saying, I got to go get Roland Hazard. He's sick in Africa. Now, in 1926, you don't take a jet plane to Africa. You're taking a boat, you know. And but Courtney Baylor has a book out called Remaking a Man. It's a little pamphlet, actually, and it reads like sponsorship. It reads like AA sponsorship. You said we have to get the tenseness out of the alcoholic. And he treated maybe, 1,000 different people, part of the Emanuel movement out of Boston. He's one of those unsung heroes, and also the guy who wrote the 24-hour-a-day book, I believe, was also.
You're going to connect it that way, Richmond Walker.
Yeah, and he's the one that got sober under Courtney Baylor, too. So it's an interesting guy. But if you look up Remaking a Man and Baylor, you can download the PDF and just read it. It's a fascinating read.
Okay, anyone else? Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.